Happy Friday, everybody. It is September 25th. It's our long-form, in-depth interview here on Mining Stock Daily. We have three segments. Two special guests I'm going to introduce. I'm really excited. First, we talk to a good friend and a mentor of mine, Mr. Steve Enders, who is the head of the mining department at the Colorado School of Mines, and also involved in a very cool copper project in Botswana. We then hear from Kai Hoffman for the Ore & Ink Weekly. And then we turn to a great friend of the show and of the industries, Miss Daniela Cambone, talking about her new role. And also, we kind of break it down and talk about journalism as a whole. And, it's not all about gold and mining. It's kind of just a heartfelt, great conversation. So it's wonderful to welcome Daniela back to the industry after taking on motherhood. We'd like to thank all of our sponsors, but our full sponsors we would like to thank would be Integra Resources, Western Copper and Gold, Rio 2, and Corvus Gold. Thank you so much for your continued support of Mining Stock Daily. Please go to the miningstockdaily.com website, find a full list of sponsors. You can click on those graphics and a link will send you to each of those companies' web pages. Take a look at them. Might be something you see that you like. All right, everybody, we're going to get into my first conversation. I'm really excited that this could happen. All right, take care, everybody. Enjoy. And welcome in. This is our first segment for the Mining Stock Daily in-depth long-form interview that we like to air Friday mornings to get through the last day of trading and into the weekend. This is a very special interview for me because I'm introducing you all to not only is he a good friend, he's also a mentor of mine and one of the culprits for getting me into this crazy business, and that's Mr. Steve Enders. Steve, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Trevor. Yes, I'm delighted to be able to talk with you today.
You are currently the head of the mining department at Colorado School of Mines. You have not always been in academia. This has been probably, I don't know, maybe the last 10 years or so part of your career. Previous roles, you were a president at Phelps Dodge. You were also the senior vice president of worldwide exploration for Newmont. You have accomplished a lot in your career. Setting back, I kind of want to ask you, we're going to start from kind of the beginning somewhat and then kind of take it into what you're seeing in exploration and the exploration markets now. But tell me, what started you on this journey of wanting to be a rock licker?
I was a year and a half old, Trevor, and I don't remember this, but my mother told me I would sit on the side of this, in the sidewalk and pick up stones and put them in my pocket when I was a year and a half old. So there was something that attracted me to rocks as a kid. And then as I got older, my father was he worked for Republic Steel in Cleveland, Ohio, and he would bring home iron ore, specular hematite and other things. And I thought that was really pretty cool. And so I've always had an interest in rocks, and mining became something I became interested in when I went to the School of Mines. Otherwise, it was just rocks.
There was a time you went to the School of Mines and you stepped into industry, but then you went back and started more academic work and got your PhD. Tell me why you decided to go back and work on a higher level education.
So I did a career talk for SME several years ago, and I did my career timeline against the backdrop of metal prices. And so I had to look at what to do during the downturns. And so at a downturn in the uranium price in the mid-70s after Three Mile Island, I decided I needed to retool, and I went back, got a master's, and hit the market when gold was $850 an ounce and silver was $50 an ounce in 1981 or 1982, and was on a roll for a number of years. And eventually got a job with Phelps Dodge, and I was at Morenci, Arizona, and I was the chief geologist, and I had 30 geologists, and probably 9 or 10 drill rigs, and we were drilling the bejesus out of Morenci, and I didn't know anything about the geology, nothing other than what my staff told me. And so I had all these questions that I couldn't answer, and management decided that they wanted to do some research and pay for a student to study the deposit. And I couldn't find anyone. And finally I said, well, maybe I should do it. And they sent me back to school. It was really awesome. And so the story is, I was in my mid-40s, and the students I was with in my cohort were in the mid-20s. And so they would need to show an ID, a student ID, to be able to prove that they could get a beer at the local brewery. And I had to show a student ID so I could get a student discount. It was a really great experience for me.
But you did some pretty interesting work in that master's, and when you were being funded through Morenci. I believe it is kind of a, I think I've been told it's some groundbreaking work on porphyry deposits. I know you are bashful enough not to call it groundbreaking, but I'll put it up there on the pedestal. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was actually my PhD dissertation. Okay. Research that I did for Phelps Dodge at Morenci. And I just wanted to know how the deposit formed, and not originally, like in the Earth's crust, but how it formed to be economic. And it turns out it's a process called supergene enrichment, which happens at the surface of the Earth, where you have the intersection of the lithosphere and the hydrosphere and the atmosphere, and it turns out to be the biosphere. And so I studied Morenci at the regional scale all the way down to the isotopic scale. And the breakthrough work that we did was on the biological scale, where we demonstrated that if it wasn't for the role of iron oxidizing bacteria, the deposit never would have been economic and wouldn't have been a mine today, because it would have been eroded away and been lower grade and never economic. It was profound. And it turned over 100 years of dogma in how that particular geologic process occurred. And now it's a fairly well understood process. And most people know that bacteria is used in the leaching of oxide and sulfide leachable copper ores. So it was neat to tie what happens in industry back to what happens in nature, and then tie that back into what happens in industry.
The tide really changed for porphyry style deposits after that?
No, I would say no. But one of the key parameters that we discovered is that you really need a lot of oxygen in your heaps to accelerate the process. And I think certainly at Morenci, they decided to put more air into their heaps. And whether or not that was a result of my work or not, it was coincidental and was certainly supported by the research that I did.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about porphyry deposits. You know, a lot of people that listen to this show are not geologists, they're not mine engineers. A lot of them are speculators and investors in early exploration. There was a time where everybody was going after big porphyry style deposits. And so I wanted to get your take here. Things about porphyry exploration that you think listeners really should know and understand as or before they decide to put their money into some of those projects.
Yeah, be prepared for the long term. So porphyry copper deposits are very, very large copper deposits, and they're generally very low grade. And because they're very large, they take a long time to explore and develop. And because they're low grade, oftentimes they are marginally economic. So the work that Rich Lavelle and Michael Doggett have done, and the work that Rich Lavelle and I did when we were working together at Phelps Dodge, showed that the mean time frame for discovery of a porphyry copper deposit and development to initial production was 27 years, which is giving it a 4-year exploration period to make a discovery, and then another 23 years to actually develop it into a mine. The range was as fast as 6 or 7 years, and the long terms were 50 years or more, but the average time was 27 years. And when you think about that, you have to be in it for the long run, and you have to have cycles work in your favor, both technology cycles as well as metal cycles, financing cycles. And so I think porphyry copper deposits are really great plays for major companies in my own right, my own sense. And I think that they're very attractive exploration targets for smaller companies, so long as they don't let their pants get too big and think that they're actually going to turn it into a mine. If they want to make a discovery and sell it or partner it with someone who can stand it for the long term, then that makes sense to me business-wise. But porphyry copper deposits are not my favorite investment personally today. I prefer, you know, deposits that are similar to what they have in Poland or Central Africa. For example, those are really nice deposits, and certainly smaller deposits, what we call massive sulfide deposits, are of interest to me because they're smaller scale, they're higher grade, they can be put into production typically faster than a porphyry can.
I think I first heard the saying from you, you don't discover or drill a porphyry deposit, you build it through the drill. It does kind of make me chuckle sometimes. A lot of times I see these news releases that have drill results and say they're pretty good, you know, broad intervals of decent porphyry style mineralization, typically smaller grade, which is expected, but broad intervals. But I'm still just kind of like, well, you haven't really proved anything yet, you know. So what you're saying is, take some of that information with a little bit of a grain of salt in the early stages of the exploration.
Yeah. So just to give you some odds, the odds of discovering a porphyry deposit that ends up going through full feasibility from a prospect, so prospect to feasibility stage, and you would assume that a full feasibility with a positive outcome would be turned into a mine. Those odds are 1 in 3,500. Those are really long odds. And so it's really rare that a deposit will actually ever be economic today. And that's what we see. Lots and lots of mines have been built in the past, economic today. There's a robust pipeline of marginally economic projects like porphyries. There are some that are being developed, but they all have their time and place, in my view, in terms of the economic cycle of what might be developable over time. So here's what we think. Making a discovery of a porphyry copper deposit is a technical thing. Making a discovery of a mine is really about the economic and technical and legal and environmental and social factors that allow you to actually develop it. So you can discover a deposit, but you have to build a mine. You have to make a mine.
Kind of change course here and sure. Little stories. So I said you are a culprit for me getting into this industry, which I'm forever grateful for. For that, listeners out there, so about 5 years ago when I was just learning about mining, I was teamed up with Steve on a project, and he mentioned copper deposits in Poland. We were working with KGHM at the time, and I knew nothing. And then through this, Steve got me involved with a company you're working with. That's Cooper Canyon Capital and the Khoemacau Copper Project in Botswana. You really are a copper guy before any other metal, I believe. Would you agree with that?
It's my favorite. Certainly, I use architectural copper in my home. I have artwork made out of copper. It's certainly more affordable than if I did that in gold. But honestly, my career was started out in uranium, and that was short-lived. And then I got involved into gold, and that got me into copper, which got me back into gold, and now I'm back into copper again. So I've really cycled in and out of exploration, project development, and mining operations in both gold and copper actually throughout my entire life.
Tell us about Khoemacau. It's a private company. I do remember that Royal Gold purchased the silver stream to help fund the project in Botswana. It's very exciting copper project. However, it's since it's private, there's not a whole lot of eyes on it in the market every day.
Yeah, so I was one of five former executives from Phelps Dodge and Freeport who decided we want another kick at the can. And so we co-founded a private company in the copper space originally with Barclays Natural Resource Investments back in January of 2010. And our objective was to find a great copper opportunity and add value to it through the investment of our own equity and the equity of Barclays investors at the time. And then in typical private equity fashion, take our value off the table at a time when we could get a multiple return on our investment of money. And that's still our business plan, although our partner now is Global Natural Resource Investments. And we are about 80% completed in construction of a 10,000 ton per day underground series of actually three underground mines, each contributing a third to that production schedule. And we're producing copper. The reserve base is about 2% copper, and the silver is about 20 grams per ton silver. It's really the best construction stage project in the world, in my opinion. And it's private, and we're going to put it in production and then see what happens at that point.
Why go private? Why not go the typical fashion and hit it to the public markets and raise money that way?
So that goes back to metal cycles again, Trevor. So we formed the company in 2010, and we looked at probably 200 to 250 copper opportunities between 2010 and early 2013. And if you look at copper prices at that period of time, they did nothing but go higher, 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 higher. And our investment criteria was we wanted to own it all, and we wanted to buy it cheap. So there aren't many opportunities like that. And we identified Khoemacau as one of those. And we bought it at a time when the copper price continued to go down and down and down and down and down. And so one of our exit strategies was to go public, but not in a declining copper price market. And so the copper price bottomed out at 195 in fall of 2015, right when we were taking our feasibility study to market. There was very little interest in it, and people who had interest in it didn't want to pay us anything for it. So we said, well, we'll just sit on it for a while. And it allowed us to sharpen our pen and create develop a better project design. And at the end, we said, we're just going to build it. We're just going to build it and operate it ourselves, because we could get more money that way than putting it in the market that wasn't favorable to us. It also reduced our regulatory burden a lot. I mean, we didn't have to deal with stock markets and reporting and all that other stuff. And it doesn't mean that we are anything except properly governed, for example, and would be totally appropriate to be a public company. We just don't have that burden to deal with.
Right. Tell me about Africa as a copper jurisdiction. I mean, obviously, Robert Friedland has the Ivanhoe. And Ivanhoe has a project up in the DRC. Botswana is an interesting play. I don't think a lot of people expect copper plays out of Botswana, but there's some good projects down there. Other companies surrounding you are continued for development. Do you see just unlimited copper upside in Africa that maybe would provide more supply than what, you know, companies like Chile could do or has done in the past?
I don't know. I can't answer that yet. You know, the bulk of Africa's copper lies in the Katanga province in the DRC and in northern Zambia in the copper belt. That's been around for decades and decades and decades. And it's the biggest copper belt in Africa and one of the bigger copper belts in the world. Cooper Canyon is working in the Kalahari copper belt, which is an extension of African geology into Botswana and Namibia that has historically been known for small but high-grade deposits, underground mineable. They're measured in a few million tons at 1 to 2% or maybe a little bit higher. small scale stuff. We were fortunate to have discovered Zone 5 and adjacent deposits in Botswana, and Zone 5 is on the order of 100 million tons of 2% copper, 20 grams silver. And that's two orders of magnitude bigger than anything else in the whole belt. So I'm a bull on what the Kalahari Copper Belt can do. But it has a long life ahead of us in terms of discovery.
Where do you think we are in this copper cycle?
I'm a bull on copper.
What about right now? Where are we at in this cycle?
I think, well, I'll tell you what, I like where we are in this point in the cycle. I think there's room for copper to get higher in price. It's going to have to be driven by a number of other factors. I mean, I think we're at, what, $3.05 today or something like that. That's a pretty healthy price. I can't really predict where it's going to go on the upside. If I did, I'd probably be in a different business. if you take a look at the world's inventory of developable projects, most of them need a higher price than $3.05 to trigger their development, if you really want to be honest about it. So I think that the copper price will inevitably have to rise for the mining business to supply the copper that the world's going to need in a market where we're going to continue to use more and more and more copper.
This is one of the things that I love the most about you, because I always call geologists the most eternal optimist in the entire world, except for you. come on, Steve, how many times have I thrown a project or an idea at you and you've ever said, that looks good? I'll tell you, it's a zero. Because it takes a lot to like really impress you with projects. Why is that?
I've been spoiled.
Yeah?
I've been spoiled. I've been involved in my career in world-class gold and copper operations and in the exploration for and discovery of those. And I know how hard it is for those projects that are new projects and new discoveries, how hard it is to get them into production. I just know that. Such that it takes a lot for me to be impressed. I have a really tight filter, but I can tell you what passes that filter is typically really successful.
What is the filter? What are a couple of things in the filter?
I'm going to say this tongue in cheek, big and high grade.
Mm-hmm.
I say that tongue in cheek, but there's a lot of factors that go into it, and it's not just geologic. You know, it's the geopolitical factors, it's the environmental and social factors, it's the economic and technology factors that all go into this. And I have been successful in exploring for both gold and copper deposits using models, if you will, that were ridiculously low grade, but they had all the right characteristics of size and mineability and treatability that everyone else would have passed them up, and everyone else was looking for high grade. And I said, well, I think the high grade might be surrounded by low grade. Let's look for low grade. And inside of the low grade, we found more high grade. And I've done just the opposite. I've looked at projects where everyone says, boy, this is a great project. And I look at that and I say, you don't have enough grade. You don't have enough size or scale to make this thing work. It just comes from experience.
Yeah.
And working with a lot of other great professionals that are partners to mine and colleagues to mine and coworkers that have helped me understand what's valuable in the business.
I know a vast majority of your time right now is focused on students, but are there some exploration and development projects out there in the market right now that you know of that do look exciting? I'm not saying they're endorsements from you, but that you think have a pretty good chance of making it.
My favorite is Khoemacau in Botswana, I'm unabashedly pro Khoemacau, but I say that because of its size and its grade and the discoveries we have in adjacent deposits around it. But also, I want to go back and tell you that I think Botswana is one of the best jurisdictions I've ever worked in my career.
Hmm.
The government, the regulators and the government officials. They all understand mining and the value of mining, and they understand the technical details. They have held our feet to the fire from a regulatory perspective, but they've also been smart about it, and they've been helpful when it's been important to be helpful.
Okay, so let's talk about the next generation. You are now an educator. You are a department head. You know, every year at PDAC, you take a group of students from the Colorado School of Mines and just, you know, spend 4 or 5 days letting them use their creativity and ask a lot of questions, which is why I've always appreciated our relationship, because I asked a lot of naive questions of things I literally didn't know with you, and you always gave me a great answer. But what do you want the next generation of exploration geologists to understand? Like, if you can kind of wrap it in one blanket summary.
They have to have an ability to be as good as the past generations of explorers in terms of characteristics of who they are, right? They have to be, curious. They have to be creative. They have to have fire in the belly. And what I mean by that is they have to have passion for discovery, if you want to talk on the discovery side. But they also have to have an ever increasing knowledge of not just geology and minerals and exploration techniques, but they have to understand the business world, and they have to understand how a discovery is valued from a mining perspective, a processing perspective, an environmental perspective, social perspective, and to be able to make decisions early on that there's a project that no one else likes that they think has the potential, and to be able to say no really quickly on things that they say is never going to make it. And that's a lot for particularly young geologists to get a hold of, because they typically get schooled in economic geology, as an example, which is the study of ore deposits. You can get courses in mineral exploration. You can take courses in mineral processing, for example, or mine planning, but it's hard to do that in an undergraduate career, and it's hard to do that in a graduate program when you're focused on a particular research project or only have so much time to put into your courses. So it's really up to universities to work together and to work with industry to train this next generation of graduate that's going to be entering the business. And I'll add to that, they have to have an understanding of how technology is going to help them. And it's machine learning, it's artificial intelligence, it's virtual reality, it's augmented reality, it's how does that interface with people. There's more than ever for them to know. Mm-hmm. But the difference is they spend so much less time in the field, because so much of what we do now is looking at covered plays, where being in the field is important, but doesn't take the same amount of time it used to.
Okay. How about for new or younger speculative money and capital being put into exploration plays and exploration companies right now? We've seen a lot of it. There's a lot of money coming in that we hadn't seen in many years. What would your advice be to them?
Do your research, right? Don't be a punter, like they call them in Australia. Don't just say, well, I like this, I'm going to do these because because I like the glossy cover on their annual report, or I like their website, or, you know, I don't believe hardly anything that you read, honestly. Look into the details. And if you don't have the expertise, you need to find that expertise. And there's a couple ways to do that. One is you find people in the business who have a reputation and an understanding of how the business works, and you ask for advice. The other way to do is to look for management teams that have a track record and invest in projects and invest in companies that are led with a top-notch management team. Okay, so there are two different ways to look at that. But I would never want to just make a punt because some broker is telling me that I've got a company that I've got a great project, because I can tell you 1 in 10,000 gold projects are good and 1 in 3,500 copper projects are good. So how do you make those investments? How do you decide? It's the people. So it's the people that will help you understand the questions to ask, and it's the management teams and their track record of success that would be an indicator of whether a company is worth investing in and whether or not they put their money into it or not. That's how I would do it. I would do my research. I personally invest in companies that I'm working in and working with because I know them and I know the people. But I don't do a lot of investing in the minerals and mining sector in companies that I don't know about, because I think the odds are really long. It doesn't mean you can't make a lot of money, and it doesn't mean you can't be lucky. But if you want to be planful and thoughtful about it, you want to look for the quality of the people involved and the quality of the projects that they have. That's how I would do it.
It always kind of surprised me, like, how long ago? It might have been 5-6 years ago when you and I first got to know each other. as you were talking, I was kind of back in my mind. I was thinking about just like how much I've learned from you. Right. When we first met, I knew nothing. I didn't know what a PFS was. I didn't know anything, you know, and then I get just basically drinking from the fire hose from a couple months working with you. And we've been, you know, I consider you a really, really good friend. But and one of the best educators I've ever had.
Wow, I appreciate that. I like to invest in people that I think have potential to be able to make an impact. You're one of them. There are many others that I work with, but it goes back to people. I mean, it's people make it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so think about it this way. We have this thing now in the mining business called ESG, environmental, social, and governance. It really relates to people, really relates to people. Mm-hmm. And we're mining and selling products, mineral and metal products, to society. That's people, right? And so it's really all about people.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. I really appreciated this.
You're welcome. All right. It's been fun.
People ever want to follow up with you on maybe on the Khoemacau stuff? How could they reach out to you?
I can always be reached out at my mines email address, Okay. Which is menders@mines.edu. I'm on a website, but it's very easy. I'm always happy to talk with people and refer them to others if I can address their questions or comments or.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Easy way to do it. Happy to talk to him.
All right.
Okay.
Sounds Thank great. You. All right. That's Steve Enders. We're going to take a short break and we will be back.
Everybody, to another update of the Orenic Index. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the CEO of Orenic. And the Orenic Index increased in the week ending September 18th to 76.31 points from an updated 71.85 points a week ago as brokered activity has increased. The aggregate financings announced increased to $151.4 million. That's a four-week high, which includes 7 brokered financings for $77 million. That's also a four-week high, and that included 3 bought deal financings for roughly $67.5 million. Also a four-week high. Average offer size increased, therefore, to $3.7 million. That's also a four-week high, while the number of financings increased to 41. Financing highlight was Wallbridge Mining opening a bought deal financing to raise $56 million that was underwritten by BMO Capital Markets, and they're planning to issue 49 million shares at $1.15. Other financing highlights included Desert Mountain Energy raising $13 million on a best efforts basis, Kodiak Copper leveraging their recent drill results and raising $12.52 million on a best efforts basis. And financing's closings the past week included Integra Resources closing a $31.28 million Canadian financing, Aftermath Silver closing a $17.14 million financing, Monarch Gold a $13 million financing, and Silver Dollar closed a $10.5 million financing that was done on a best efforts basis. That's it from Orin Inc. for this week. Make sure to follow us at Orin Inc. on Twitter and orininc.com for our weekly newsletter. Thanks for dialing in and thanks for subscribing.
And we're back with our second segment of our Friday in-depth interview here on Mining Stock Daily. Here's a guest that we all know. I'm just so happy to welcome her back to Mining Stock Daily because there's a lot to catch up on. And that is now the editor-at-large and anchor at Stansberry, Miss Daniela Cambone. Daniela.
Dun, da, da, da. Segue. Thank you for that introduction, Trevor. I am very happy and honored to be doing my first interview with you since I'm back.
I know. Welcome back.
Yay. I love it. I'm so happy to be back.
All right, we're gonna talk business, but first, how's mom life?
Mom life to twins, by the way. is something I could have never prepared enough for. You can read all the books you want and think, you know, you're ready. And then it's the most incredible thing I've ever done and the most challenging I've ever done. And I'm absolutely loving it. So it's good.
Yeah.
Lack of sleep. But you just, you know, we were talking about this offline. You just kind of learn to plow through and live without sleep.
Yeah. Parenting something else. I mean, I've got a few years experience.
Yeah. Yeah. You have experience. You have experience. So I'm going to have to get tips from you. So I don't have to, you know, lecture them yet or anything. I'm just, you know, a win for me is like, yay, I got a longer than a 30-minute nap time, you know? So
yeah, I think so. You certainly... My best piece of advice would just continue to be as patient as you can because it's hard.
And that's what I try and just always remain, you know, composed. Don't get inside my head. I just do basically. I just need to do what I need to do, and be there for them. It's really important for me to be there. Mm-hmm. For them.
It is nice to have that ability, you know, with kids and family to kind of take, you know, each and every day you're able to kind of separate yourself from work and the markets and realize that, well, this is my greater purpose now. Like, work is fine and it makes me whole, but my family really is everything.
And that's so true, Trevor. Like, you know, the other day, you know, like all of us, we have our good days, whatever, bad days at work. I was having a bit of a challenging day and, now I see my life, like the line has been drawn, like Daniela before kids and now Daniela after kids. It's kind of like, this is part two of my life now. And before I probably would have like mulled it over and been angry and, you know, all day, but no, like this time it was different. I shut the MacBook down and then I held my kids and it just helps refocus everything. And you realize, wow, this, like everything else just doesn't matter anymore.
You think it's changed you as a professional in this short period of time?
Yeah, definitely. I can't even believe how much it's changed me, but I just, it just places a different importance on things in life. Like other things just don't matter anymore. They're really the only thing. And my family, my husband, my parents, and some close friends that really, really matter to me at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Health and family. That's it. Like, yeah, I love my career. I absolutely do. But you know, nowhere close to my children or my family. So it definitely helps put things in perspective.
Yeah. Let's talk about your career. Big change.
Yes.
Big change.
yeah.
Like I said at the beginning, you left Kitco. That announcement was made about a month ago. You land at Stansberry.
Yes.
What's, you know, why, I guess, you know, why the change?
Yeah. Why the change? So it was a, I just want to start by saying it was a really difficult decision. I loved Kitco and my role at Kitco. I didn't see it as a job. I really saw it like it was almost my own company. That's how I ran the media department. So it was very difficult. I mean, I was there from day one, you know, and I saw the incredible evolution of the brand to where it's now. So to walk away from that was a very difficult decision. That said, I wasn't looking to make a change. So it's not like I was actively looking, and throughout the years, I had been approached by other competitors, media outlets to come and work for them. And I just wasn't at that stage. I wasn't ready to make the change. When Stansberry came to me, and this was all during my mat leave and everything happened so quickly because I was expecting to go back to Kitco. And they came and said, hey, we'd love for you to help us build our brand up in a media division and start do what you're doing for us. And I saw it as a new and exciting challenge. You know, a part of me thought, wow, am I really going to leave now this well-oiled machine that's Kitco News to go and restart? But, you know, I just thought it would be a really interesting challenge. And it also involves less travel than what I was doing at Kitco. Like people, you know, maybe didn't realize it, but I was on the road every month, multiple times during a month. Rarely I was home. It's taxing. It's tough. You know, Trevor, you do a lot of the shows. And I just think, you know, at this point in my career and with motherhood, this was an opportunity I just couldn't say no to. So as difficult as it was to leave Kitco, and I love Kitco, I left on very good terms. I still speak to people that were, you know, in my team. I just felt this was a move I had to make.
So what is going to be different at Stansberry as far as the content delivery?
Right. And thank you for asking that, because that was another element of it. Of course, I've been covering the gold market inside and out for over a decade. The cool thing about Stansberry is I will still be covering commodities, but their reach is not just commodities, right? They cover all aspects of financial markets. So I'll be able to talk about US equities, talk more monetary policy. So it's also gives me the range of covering broader content, which I also was looking to do. So I still get to do the gold stuff I love, still get to do the mining I love, but more, more general content. So I'm excited for that.
I remember not this past PDAC, but the PDAC before you and I sat down for an interview, and we were talking about kind of the evolution of your career into precious metals. And like when you first came on to Kitco, you knew very little about precious metals. In fact, I think you said you were working in like insurance, like covering insurance.
I had covered when I first started in. First of all, I never thought I would land in financial journalism. I'm like the last person. I thought I was going to be doing politics. And I, you know, for some whatever reason, I ended up getting a gig at Magazine Finance, which no longer exists, but it used to come with La Presse here in Montreal. And I fell in love with financial journalism, but I was covering like Canada's banking and insurance sector. Yeah. Then I moved to Rome. I worked in government, doing public relations. I started working in television, but again, I was covering politics, social issues. And when I moved back to Montreal, after doing 5 years in Rome, I had applied for this job at Kitco. And I remember going in for the interview, and the guy interviewing me was no longer there. It was like, so what do you know about the gold market. And I was like, actually, absolutely nothing. And he's like, well, I hope you know, it's a very interesting crowd. And I'll always remember when he said that, because it didn't make sense to me. I'm like, what does he mean? Like, what do you mean it's an interesting crowd? Like, it's a different crowd. And as you know, Trevor, it is, it's an incredible crowd. But we are different folk, you know? So, and then, yeah, I obviously fell in love with covering gold, because you don't realize it, but there's just so many facets to covering gold that forces you to know and understand about what's happening around the world. And I love it.
Yeah.
Still love it till this day, you know, 12 years later.
So you're going to pick up more topics of conversation and probably, I would assume, a greater list of people to interview on a lot of different topics. You know, what's one topic outside of the gold mining space that maybe mostly, you know, causes you to like, man, I'm really interested in this, but I need to study up?
That's a good question, Trevor. And I want to say that's the beauty about journalism.
I agree.
And why, I wanted to be a journalist since I was 3 years old, by the way. It's not like something I just fell into. Like, no, I purposely paved the path, my path, my education path to get me to the point where I am, you know, today. And one of the beauties about journalism is you just don't know what you might be asked to cover one day. So when I had started covering insurance and banking, I knew zero, you know, and again, with the precious metals. But you just have to learn to, so for example, if I had to cover, you know, a soccer match tomorrow, you know, I might not know any of the people's names or the teams or anything, but I would quickly have to learn and adapt. You just have to think on your feet. But, you know, one topic I would cover, I don't know. I'm really game for anything, honestly. You know what I love covering, what I, you know, if I had to change career, my I love like more Today Show type content, like meeting people who are really making a difference.
Yeah.
I would, you know, if I had to, you know, in 10 years do something else, that's what I would love to do, is just talk to regular folks, not, you know, not mining tycoons, not politicians, not famous actors or Shark Tank stars, just regular people making a difference. I love those type of stories.
We're not seeing enough of that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my opinion.
I just, you know, when I speak with people, you know, whether it's the guy at the bus stop or, you know, I like just talking to people, and I always say everyone has a story. Everyone has an interesting story. It's your job as a journalist to find out what that is, but everyone has a great tale to tell.
Yeah.
And, that's what I would love to do.
Yeah, this is such an interesting conversation. Maybe it's not going in the direction we originally planned, but
yeah,
yes, but that's fine, because I'm happy to have conversations like this, especially on volatile weeks when everybody's a little down in the earth, in the dumps,
exactly, with
precious metals. But okay, so, you know, I have a master's degree in journalism. I have interviewed anybody from, literally, I've interviewed Conan O'Brien in his office in New York before he moved
to
LA.
That's cool. I didn't know that, Trevor.
I've interviewed a cocaine smuggler in Colombia before. And I've interviewed so many people in the precious metal. Like, so, but like the journalists, you have to be so versatile, right?
Yes.
I mean, and not only versatile, but you have to be humble enough to like go in there, like, you know, unsubjectively, and let that person tell the story.
Right.
And the reason I say this is because I feel like I'm one to, like, you know, journalism and journalists are, get such a bad rep lately.
Yeah.
And not always rightfully so, in my opinion,
right,
but yes, mistakes are made. What do you think the status of journalism is right now in these very volatile times as a society?
Yeah. Well, I think the problem is, like, you and I, we both studied journalism. You know, I did my BA in journalism, and like you did my master's in journalism, and I take journalism very seriously. I am a passionate journalist, and full disclosure, when I was hiring For people in my team, I always gave a preference to people because these days, anyone can say, oh, I'm a journalist, right? I always gave a preference to someone who actually studied journalism. And not that you need to go to school to become a great journalist. There are many great journalists who never went to J school, but it shows me that, wow, you really took it seriously enough or you loved it enough that that's what you chose to study. So I always gave the J school grads, more of a chance and an edge during interviews. But the direction it's taking, I think it's getting pretty ugly, mostly because social media, like I said, can give anyone a microphone and a lot of people consider themselves reporters and journalists when they're not. I think a big part of the problem, especially with American media, is it's no longer journalism, it's editorializing. And, you know, whether you watch CNN or Fox, they're not doing their job as journalists. They're telling me what I should be thinking. And that's the complete opposite of what journalism should be doing. You need to be presenting me the full story and then I'm deciding for myself, but that's not happening anymore. The narrative is being shoved down people's throats depending on the channel you're watching. And it angers me. Yeah. I think in Canada, I think we're doing a better job. I don't think we've gone completely down that road. And yes, there's still outlets like the BBC that do a good job. But I think, yeah, American journalism in particular has gotten so ugly. And now with the demise, like there's no more magazines, there's no more newspapers. Like my local paper here, you know, I'm at my parents' home here in Montreal, the Montreal Gazette. I remember, you know, the Saturday edition was a big, fat mm-hmm. paper. And now it arrives, it's like 3 pages and it's all like, you know, copy-pasted from various journals or their advertorials. It's like, there's no news. What happened to news? And, you know, people are getting their news from Twitter and thinking they're being informed. And it's a sad state of affairs. I think you have to really educate yourself and do a lot of digging to get real facts these days because journalists just aren't doing a good job at it.
I remember there was a short period of time when Al Jazeera made a run here in the US.
Yeah. Yes.
And I remember like watching Al Jazeera and I was like, this is the fundamentals of what journalism is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And then they were gone.
Yes. And I absolutely agree. They were doing a great job, but it didn't survive. It's almost like people didn't want it. People actually want to be told this is what I should be thinking. Or people are looking for an outlet that just agrees with what they're thinking. And they're like, aha, see, I knew I'm thinking along the right lines.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's... I don't know. It's just a sad, sad state of affairs. And I think, I think then there's other people who are really unplugging from mainstream media. And I think this is why shows like, you know, like Kitco News or Stansberry Research or YouTube in general, like, you know, I'm sure you've seen your views skyrocket this year, right? Why? Yes. Because people are looking for alternative sources of media. They no longer just want to rely on CNBC or Bloomberg for their financial news. I think especially when it comes to financial news, because these mainstream guys, they're not covering the miners. Yeah, they'll talk gold maybe once in a blue moon when gold's rising or sinking. But, you know, a lot of people feel like they can't get their financial news from these mainstream players.
You know, Daniela, so when the COVID crisis hit in February... in March and mm-hmm. we got put on lockdown. Obviously everybody was at home. Everybody was consuming so much content. And so myself and the podcast, like I knew I had to get creative. Things were changing so fast that I started putting out more content, like multiple episodes a day. Like some days I was producing 4 or 5 back then.
Yeah.
Cause it's like every hour something was changing. Like there was, you know, people were fleeing to the dollar, gold was dumping and then gold was rebounding. But you know who we really missed?
Who?
You.
Well, hold on. So, you know, what's funny. It's funny you say that because I wasn't planning to work that up until like the day before I gave birth, by the way. I was like, oh, maybe I'll take like 2 weeks off. But like you said, it was such rock and roll times. There's so much content. I was like, I can't. And again, that's where my passion of journalism comes in. I was like, I can't not cover. I can't. Right. I'm just not that personality that I could just be like, oh, I'm just going to like take it easy now. It's like, I see that opportunity and I want to do it more. You know, I want to do those interviews. I want to inform people. And the views were there. People couldn't get enough of the content.
And you were so pregnant. And I was just like, I remember
interviewing Jim Rogers. He came like the week I was pregnant. He came to New York and he saw me. He's like, holy moly. Like I was really pregnant, you know, yeah. With twins, especially like it looked like I was going to pop at any second. And I was going to Vrick. I did Vancouver. I was 7 months pregnant. I guess it's just my drive, you know, and I knew that I always double checked that I was safe to fly or safe to work. And I was given the all clear to do so. But I was very pregnant.
Well, and then you were very much in, you know, the first stages of motherhood in the summer when Gold really had that big run up. I mean, were you like, oh, this is fun, this is nice, but like, this is my duties? Or was part of you like, oh, I wish I could be interviewing people right now?
I thought like, okay, you know, the universe has it out for me because patient. Like, what are the chances? Like, I missed the biggest gold run in history. I am like, you know, been interviewing people on this topic ad nauseam.
I know.
Waiting for this moment. And then it happens while I'm on maternity leave, you know? I would have loved to, you know, cover that breakout. But then, you know, I looked at my twins and at the end of the day, I, with all due respect to the audience, I was appreciating the time with my twins. I knew I was going to go back full time probably in September. So what was really going through my head is I was so happy for patient investors. That was really the feeling I was feeling, was like, wow, okay. I felt like so many must feel so vindicated right now. And I was happy. I was just happy for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know I was getting so many emails. People were like, you need to come back. How could you be gone now? But I'm back now. So.
Okay. We're going over time. I promise. I said 15 minutes and we're now over 20, which is fine. Cause this conversation doesn't happen very often, but so now with this, with the new gig at Stansberry, what do you think, from what you did at Kitco, let's just focus on the gold and mining space. I'm assuming some of the same contacts that you've carried over the last 10 years will be seen on Stansberry.
I'm just curious,
like, what about different opinions that may be against gold? Like, you know, I feel like we're just big gold bugs. Like, I try to do my best to understand why not gold. I've tried to understand the whole crypto and Bitcoin thing. It seems like all the Bitcoin people are coming out like why gold is a fraud. And I just like, I don't know. I mean, why does it have to be one or the other type of thing?
Right.
You know,
right.
Are you going to be able to like show different sides of this thing?
Yeah. And in fairness to Kitco, I mean, I wasn't allowed to interview bearish people. You know, that was one of the, when we started Kitco News, I was really adamant about that. I was like, look, I just don't want, now it did happen that I had a lot of mostly pro gold people on. But throughout the years, we also had people who hated gold, loved Bitcoin or whatever. I mean, I had Mark Cuban on calling gold a pet rock and how it was a relic and the stupidest investment you could ever make. So I did have the freedom to cover bearish territory. Now, we got a lot of hate mail when we did it because it's a gold site. And so the audience generally didn't like seeing naysayers and haters on the page. And I get that. So I think at Stansberry, it's probably more neutral when it comes to that. Obviously, what I've done here for my first week, I've invited a lot of fan favorites back, people that I've known for many years, that I've enjoyed interviewing. and I know the audience loves hearing from, but I absolutely do plan to bring on new voices. I've already started reaching out to some names, which I can't disclose yet, but some pretty cool people. And yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like if you want to hate gold, come on, I'd love to interview about it. So open invitation to anyone listening.
All right. You can find her on Twitter at Daniela Cambone. I have one surprise for you before I let you go. I would like to send you and your twin boys Pet Rock t-shirts.
Trevor.
So, and I don't think I have, you know, the onesie that they're going to fit in right away. We're going to have to grow into it. So, you know, but I'll
say, they are big boys. They are 5 months and over 20 pounds. They're at like 23 pounds each. So, it's crazy.
So they'll fit into a men's small. And
yeah. Yeah, shoes. They will. They're huge.
So we're going to send a couple of those t-shirts up your way that you and the twins can wear.
That is so, so thoughtful and sweet. And I want to say, Trevor, I think you do a fantastic job in this space. You know, people always ask me, are you guys competitive amongst them? I'm like, no, we're, you know, all, I think all of us in this space, we're all pretty much friends, and we realize there's room for many voices. And I think you do a great job, and you are a real journalist, one of the few remaining. And I want to just say thank you.
Oh, thanks. Got a little teary-eyed there. Thanks. That really means a lot. I've been able to learn, watch, and learn from a lot of people, including you, for a number of years. So I'm glad I get able to watch and learn. So, all right. Before we get all mushy.
Hug it out.
All right.
Social distance hug. Social distance hug.
Danielle, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you, Daniela. Thank you, Kai. Thank you, Steve. It's been a great week despite the action in the markets. That's it from us. We'll be back Monday morning with the news briefing. Have a wonderful weekend. Be kind to yourself. Be kind to others. Be well.